Good evening and a welcome to this event, part of Spain Now 2016. Spain Now is the annual season of contemporary arts and culture from Spain, and this year is our eighth year in London. Thank you also to the European Commission for hosting us, and especially Jeremy O'Sullivan, who unfortunately couldn't be with us tonight, but their continued support has been invaluable over the years. And thank you also to our panelists this evening, which I will introduce individually. We have, my left, Daphne Thiessen. Daphne is the cultural attaché at the Dutch Embassy in London, with over 15 years' experience in her post and great knowledge of the UK's art scene. I would like to say that, you know, she's single-handedly responsible for the support of the ongoing presence of Dutch arts and arts organisations over the years and within the UK cultural calendar, of obviously, Daphne and her team. Next to Daphne, we have Maria Arceo. Maria is a London-based Spanish artist who explores the close interactions between the human manipulation of the natural world. Her latest project is called Thames Memory and the Exploration of Future Dust, and is a large-scale and ambitious undertaking which pretends to draw attention to plastic debris in the Thames and its estuary. And finally, we have Martin Farrell, artist and whose company has as its aim to generate public conversations of social value. One of his latest projects is with the Fanzara Museum of Unfinished Art in Fanzara, a village in Castellón, Spain. And his very latest is part of the celebrations of the Great Fire of London, where he set the Dome of St. Paul's on fire. That event was produced together with Artichoke. So without further ado, let me just let you know that the event is being audio recorded. We're not using amplification. The mics are only for recording purposes. And also at the end, we have a roving mic. So if you have any questions, by all means, feel free to let us know and we'll pass you the mic or at any other time of the conversation. We want this to be as informal a conversation as we can make it. So to set the context of tonight's conversation and following the famous June referendum, the UK voted to leave the EU. There is a great deal of uncertainty about the potential effects of this decision and the process that will ensue on artists and arts organisations both in the UK and the EU at large. There has been a lot of talk about how the markets will respond to Brexit, but almost no talk at all about its potential effects on the arts, especially at a time when culture spending by local authorities is down by 17% nationally, 19% in London. That is a cut of £236 million. And central government cut is almost at 30% since 2010. Even Peter Bazalgette, the chair of the Arts Council, said that his organisation could not make up that funding gap as it stands. So what then when European funding for culture stops as well? Programmes like Creative Europe invested €40 million in the year 2014-2015. And back in 2008, Liverpool European Capital of Culture received an €808 million investment from European Union. But those are just figures. What about the further social ramifications for the future of the arts in the UK? The personal stories of the thousands of European artists who have chosen to base their practice in the UK, and vice versa, the thousands of UK artists who've decided to make Europe their home. Enriching its diversity in both ways. What about those networks that have been established over the years, over the past few years, throughout Europe, and that almost invariably look at the UK for inspiration and leadership? So this is the context, and I would like this, you know, our panel tonight to talk about their personal experiences, always anchoring the discussion on those experiences. I think that personal element is vital when it comes to understanding that dimension, not just the economic, financial dimension of Brexit, but what would happen and what would happen to all of us here. Martin, would you like to kick us off with what's your view?
Well, I think the thing we need to think about is what is Brexit? Because we don't actually know what it is yet. So it's very difficult to anticipate what the impact's going to be, since we seem to be in this strange situation where we voted for something we don't know what it is. You know that lovely fact about the number one Google the day after the referendum is what is the EU, which is slightly frightening. So we're in a situation where we're kind of blindfolded, which is not entirely unpleasant, I think, from an artist's point of view. I quite like not knowing what might happen next, because it makes it potentially interesting. Mm-hmm. But I think in this instance, it's also, you know, very difficult to react in a logical and practical way to the thing that might happen, because we don't yet know what it is. I do think that the actual vote speaks of a kind of retrenchment, you know, a kind of drawing back. And so my greatest concern is what lies underneath the act of voting for Brexit, because it seems to me that it's about pulling things back, retrenching, not connecting, and that's not what artists are about. They're always about the opposite, which is reaching out and trying to grapple with things and make mess and connection and conversations. And I think the whole world seems to be having a moment of, should we all get back into our shells? And I think that's the really worrying part, because it might have a bigger impact on what happens purely than the economics, although they're quite worrying too, but they're less easy to see. And we see kind of social cost of Brexit. We see people being beaten up and told to go home and nonsense like that, because somehow the phantom's been let back out into the room that some people hold these kinds of beliefs and they perhaps feel there's a space for them because of Brexit. My personal view is that the vote went the way it did because people were voting for nostalgia. They wanted the clock to turn back and the world to be different and like something warm and familiar that they remember. And so I don't think it was actually a xenophobic vote. I think it was a vote for a sort of other comfy world, but that world doesn't actually exist, I don't think, anymore.
So. And what about the art, the artists and the arts organisations? I mean, they are very much a part of that social fabric that you're referring to. And those networks that have been established over the past few decades, as I was saying, what's going to happen? Because no one knows, you're absolutely right, no one knows what's going to happen. Not yet, until not for another 2 years, at least, or so they say.
Well, having said that, I think we all know what will happen. There will be less money for the arts. Because when anything happens, it always turns into less money for the arts. So therefore, then we have to find other ways. I think I always like to think of art as, you know, the blade of grass that breaks the paving stone and comes up in spite of everything. So, of course, it will all still happen, but it'll just be harder for us and it'll be harder won and there may be less of it. And I think the thing that concerns me most is for some artists who are perhaps incredibly talented but very shy, you know, and not good at being able to fight their own corner, they will suffer the most because the loss of support will affect them more greatly than other people who are perhaps more confident and more entrepreneurial and more capable of creating opportunity for themselves. So I think it's cause for concern because we need all our voices, and it'll mean that only the bolshiest artists get heard or get to make things, potentially, or it'll be more in that space. But I think, obviously, culture won't stop and we'll continue to make work, but it's how easy it is for us to speak to each other and to connect with each other and what stands in the way. And we'll get through it somehow, but what about those people who can't? And also loss. It's difficult to lose things, I think. You know, I think making art is really difficult.
It is.
And therefore, you kind of need help. I think people have this notion that being an artist is somehow like a holiday. It's not proper work and it's funny and you want to do it, so therefore it must be really easy. And I think sometimes what is underestimated is the degree of personal investment and potentially pain to make something. You know, and just the embarrassing mortification of having had the audacity to make something that other people then might look at, and the sort of burning humiliation of having dared to do anything. I don't think you need any more obstacles in the way. And I think what Brexit does is create more obstacles.
But a project like your Fanzara project, which I'd like you to tell us a bit more about, so we put it in context. I mean, wouldn't really be as easy to carry out with the UK outside the union.
No, that's true, because I think for that project, I went to the village of Fanzara, which is a little way outside Valencia, and they have a load of fabulous graffiti art in the village, which they decided to turn the whole village into an open-air museum for urban art in order to bring life and energy and money and people back into the village, because it was one of those Spanish hill towns which is at threat of dying out because the young people leave for opportunity elsewhere. So it's a wonderful story of art bringing life and money and identity to a space. And we could go and make that work because implicit in the European Union is the idea that being connected with each other and exchanging ideas and cultural exchange is valuable. So we stand on quite solid ground at the moment because we've all decided that's important. And we had a great experience. We sat in a funny little bar in Valencia, and it looked really interesting. It was like mad. It had like weird bits of broken glass hanging from the ceilings, and it was really interesting and exciting. So we went to sit in this bar, and then we found out that it was like the student hangout, because obviously it was really interesting. So we're there, and there are these two young women. They're two young British women, and they're on the Erasmus programme, and they are so full of confidence. You know, just because they've been exposed to a whole other way of thinking and being, they're speaking really good Spanish. You know, they're situated in a different environment in a really positive way based on this platform that we should be connecting and exchanging and sharing. So obviously, if you take that platform away by removing the actual, the UK comes out of the union, then you're saying that's no longer true for us. And it then literally isn't true. Because those opportunities, you know, the underlying belief's gone, and so is the practicality of making it happen. But I think we would still make it happen, because we are really good at making things happen. But I'm quite old now, and I've been doing it for quite a long time, and I'm not particularly shy. I'm a little bit shy, but I get beyond it. But I think for someone else who had the idea and could make the work, and of course their work may have been better than my work, but they might not get to make it because it's harder to cut through. So I think the short answer is we would have still gone there and made it, but it would have been harder, but we would have prevailed.
Uh-huh. Was there a European, an intrinsic European element to the project?
No, it was more Anglo-Spanish, because I work with text, and everything in the village at the moment is pictorial, so of course it's beyond and outside of language, and I wanted to work with the villagers and the organisers to make a text-based work and then present that in Spanish and in English. So it was a kind of dual language piece of work where the design showed how the languages fitted together. And, of course, it was a political statement around similarity and connectedness by literally we stuck the two languages together. We painted them stuck together. So it wasn't particularly European, but it was Anglo-Spanish. And also for me, because all of my work is in public space, it was also an act of solidarity around public space art. I'm not a graffiti artist, but I am a big fan of that kind of urban art. So it was an opportunity for me to connect up with that side of things. So in a funny kind of way, it wasn't really a European project in identity. It was much more around that urban space work and Anglo-Spanish.
Although mobility was very much part of the project.
Yeah, we didn't have to pay VAT to each other and that kind of thing. We just ticked a box.
Maria, I mean, what do you think of the situation? I mean, whether it might not affect you as an artist, I know that you've been based in London for all of your career.
Yes, I arrived in London in the 80s, mm-hmm. So I've been here for over 30 years. In fact, I have been in London for longer than I've been in Spain. So when I'm in Spain, I'm English, and when I'm in England, I'm Spanish, and I'm like the Coloxos of Rodas. I got a foot on each country, and I'm very much part of both and not part of either in some ways. I haven't really had time to think much about how Brexit is going to affect me, to be honest, until now. But I suppose it depends very much what kind of artist you are as well. If you are someone who paints pictures in canvases on your studio and then you just sell them on the gallery. It might affect things like VAT or the amount of money that you get. And I have read contrary statements about whether now that the pound is dropping, is actually making it more interesting for foreign buyers and collectors to invest in art from the UK because obviously it's cheaper for them. However, if you are the new generation of artists who are doing projects which rely not solely on sales and on gallery-based works, then suddenly losing this big help from the EU and from all their funding abilities is going to be a big drawback, and it's also going to increase the competition in between artists, because suddenly there will be more people who rely solely on grants, and I think the Arts Council is going to be feeling the weight of all these people who suddenly have lost many other ways of...
Well, they're already saying exactly that they're not going to be able to feel it, you know, to fill the gap, so, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So... it's going to be interesting to see whether the government is going to increase the allowance for UK-based funding bodies to fill up the gaps that the European Union is going to leave behind. And then, you know, how it's going to affect specifically, I don't really know. Mm-hmm. But I think it could be a really sad thing if we suddenly lose artists which are not necessarily doing artworks for the sake of selling and for the sake of getting money, but create artworks that are a little bit more ephemeral or that they are a little bit more abstract in their concept. Mm-hmm. Especially the ones that are that encourage participation and interaction from the public and not necessarily are going to end up with a solid piece. So.
What? It goes back to those public conversations of social value that you were talking about as well. What about those, for instance, for Europe programs like Creative Europe? They always require minimum of three partners, mm-hmm. to carry out a project. That many of those programs originate where the UK takes the lead. The Commission has already said that for as long as everything's unclear as it is now, those projects will continue and applications will continue to be welcomed by UK artists and programmes. But what do you think, might be the repercussions? I mean, social repercussions. I'm not talking about financial assets. Let's put the financial, economic sort of elements to one side for a second. Let's talk about, for an artist, for the development of an artist, their practice, what do you think that might,
The social repercussions is that if the European Union carries on funding UK artists without being part of the union, I think it might create resentment with some of the other parties in other countries.
But it's already happening. I mean, Creative Europe, for instance, already welcomes applications from countries that are not part of the union. Mm-hmm. But I believe the requisite is they cannot be the lead of the project. Is that right, Daphne?
Yeah. Yeah.
And this is going to create a real problem because, as you said earlier, the UK seems to initiate most of these interactions with other countries. So I think England, the art world has changed a lot since I've been in England. When I first arrived, I had a visa. I had to kind of check regularly. And as a student, I didn't have the same opportunities, perhaps, the people that were from England that had grants and help from the government. But I also noticed a difference in the way artists have sort of interact with society. And I think... as I said, there is new types of art approach, which is a little bit more socially engaging, and perhaps not having the support necessary is going not perhaps stop it, but is going to cut the amount of projects that are going to, and it's going to make people a little bit less ambitious, perhaps. And I mean, this is all my personal fears more than beliefs, because I don't really I don't really believe that if you want to do something, an artist, when we set our heads on to doing something, we'll do it no matter what, even, you know, if we have to kind of sit under a bridge. But I don't know, it's a big incognita. And on the other side, I suppose on the other hand, you could say that it's going to also create more of a reaction, and artists might become a little bit more proactive in complaining about the injustices. So if the result of the Brexit is showing, like you were saying earlier, an increment of racial or sort of... I think that's going to kind of create more of a response from artists to kind of create a counterattack to that kind of and a political response to sort of fight that with art as a way of because art has the freedom to say things that perhaps you cannot say that other ambitions of society, like perhaps in politics, you need to be a little bit more of a. Diplomat, but with art you don't need to be a diplomat. In fact, the opposite is true. You can actually sort of challenge people. So some people are saying that perhaps young artists are a little bit more accommodated and they are a little bit more comfortable, and they haven't had to fight in the same way that other generations perhaps had to be a little bit more extreme. So perhaps that's going to be the positive consequence of what Brexit would be, that suddenly artists will become, again, more proactive in fighting injustice and social inadequacy, really.
Right. Daphne, from your point of view, I mean, how do you think the situation might develop?
So I'll paint you a picture of what's sort of the way a Dutch artist or a Dutch artistic practitioner, because we, from the embassy, we cover all disciplines. So performing arts, visual arts, creative industries, architecture, and anything in between as well. So for... I agree with you, with Maria, that for an individual youngish artist... if and when Brexit happens, England may actually become more of an exotic place. The Sex Pistols are from, you know what I mean? So, and that's in the Netherlands, that belief is still around, that, you know, in specifically in London, but also in places like Newcastle and further up north in Scotland, you still find that sort of anarchistic kind of heart, you know, beating. And in Holland we don't have that. We're quite square in the, and perhaps not in our art, but we are in, you know, we are, after all, the country is still embedded in that sort of Calvinist upbringing almost. So I think that's what's going to happen on the young. There's more established artists in any discipline. There's not going to be any change, I believe. I think it's going to be the same as it is now, i.e. they will build up their career quietly in the Netherlands and perhaps in the Low Countries, maybe Germany. Then they will be discovered by curators, who festival directors, you know. I've been pitching to some gentlemen in Folkestone. I've been pitching to Triennale in Folkestone last summer, and they're not buying any of my... so basically, these people will find their own... they will find artists in the Netherlands, and they will invite them, and then they will come across. And that's not necessarily going to change, because the people who are inviting Dutch artists, generally speaking, have a budget already. They come to me and to my colleagues for the last 5 to 10K that they need to make things happen, money-wise, that is. I've been thinking about what you said as well about artists fighting their own corner. See, I think as and when Brexit happens, because I'll add my personal note to this in a minute, as and when Brexit happens, I think it will be much harder for British artists, for youngish British artists, to actually go across to Europe. And that's going to be bad. Because, you know, there is always going to be more money across the water up until than there is here. The money for the arts was cut here, 10 years before they're even thinking about cutting in the Netherlands. We have cut monies for the arts, and it's nowhere near the level that it is at here. We're still super rich in comparison. You know, a Dutch artist who complains about their grant, they wouldn't do that through an English artist. They wouldn't dare. You said being an artist is often looked upon as being on holiday. It's funny, being a cultural attaché has the same connotation somehow. and that's probably going to be changing after Brexit. Even when Brexit happens, my holiday is over, I think.
Yes.
That's a shame, yeah. Let's think about when, you know, Brexit is going to happen, all these threats, especially the sort of bizarre rhetoric that was happening last week at the conference. If treaties are going to change, if there's not going to be free exchange of people and trade, this island is going to drift off, I think. And with it, it's wonderful art, it's wonderful music, it's wonderful anything. It's all going to drift off, and you're going to do it with yourselves, which is, you're probably going to create beautiful stuff. We're not going to enjoy it. What I have noticed personally, specifically since the 23rd of June, is that the individual artists from the Netherlands that now approach me are the ones with the sort of Dutch trade background. You know, they are stepping right in the 17th century shoes of the Dutch traders and come in with a plan of making money and rapidly. And it's I'm quite shocked. You know, A, I'm from the government, so we don't make money. And B, they normally, people who would approach us, they would literally say, it would be so fantastically helpful if the last 5K could come from you. And we're like, of course. So there is definitely a difference there. Now, personally, I'm super opinionated. I'm Dutch, obviously.
That's why you're here.
That's why I'm here. yes, I agree with Martin that a lot of the Brexit voters were seeking nostalgia. I do. I think what we heard last week, you know, the sort of scary rhetoric was actually to scare off the UKIP voters, I think. All personal opinion. I think that the people who voted Brexit, the people that we consider our sort of intelligent friends, I guess, are those anarchistic people that, you know, they used to buy the Sex Pistols albums, basically. Because there is something in Britain that they're missing, and they were hoping that by putting in a sort of anarchistic vote, people would wake up. But they never, I personally believe, they never thought it was going to go this far, literally. Now, I can also add something which maybe may find a little bit more positive to hear, is that we had Theresa May in Holland on Monday. And my ambassador told us on Tuesday that, to make a very long and boring story quite short, is that we in the Netherlands think that it may go back to the plan that Cameron was trying to negotiate in January of this year. If that's going to be the case, we can all take a very big sigh of relief and get on with our lives. And yes, the Netherlands, you know, the Dutch can be, you know, we are positive thinkers generally, but if that's going to be the case, then I'm happy. I really will be happy.
Thank you, Daphne. Actually, I meant to ask you, I mean, would in any case your funding policies change in the event of a leave? I mean, when?
When? At the moment, I have been, the post, London as a post, is still a priority post within the Dutch government, which means that the funding for arts, which means bilateral cultural exchanges, is secure until 2020. Yes, you may all come and see me until then.
join the queue.
And So, and then it will be renegotiated in 2020. Uh-huh. And I personally think that's also roughly about the time when things have settled down here. So we'll take it from there.
So you also know it's going to take this long for things to settle and to be a little clearer than they are now?
Yeah.
So does that mean that we can breathe a little bit?
Well, I think we you know, after the initial shock, you know, maybe the initial couple of weeks, and, you know, I was quite touched by people Googling EU. But it was quite sweet.
But perhaps they could have done it before they voted.
Yeah, of course. But, you know, I mean, let's
then they'd have known what they were saying no to.
Recording. But, I mean, you mentioned earlier, you know, I too am getting too old to maybe make any difference. And then we passed the baton on to the millenniums. Well, I have a lot of bad opinions about millenniums. And, you know, I'm worried about the millenniums because I think that they're really quite self-centered rather than trying to share the world with all of us. And so that'd be worrying.
Yeah, but at the same time, you had these 16 and 17-year-olds complaining that they hadn't been allowed to vote.
Yes.
And much older people actually had that future in their hands, which, if we look at it, they do have a point.
It makes sense, yeah.
It makes sense. So, I mean, that sort of demonstrated an interest and, you know, an objection, almost a political stand.
Definitely.
I was going to say, I think that's a really interesting point around, you know, out of Brexit, people have stood up and said, we think the EU is great. And you would never have seen people marching in this country in favour of the EU. It's that classic thing, isn't it, if you only appreciate something when it's taken away from you. So suddenly everyone's woken up going, oh, what are we about to lose? And so maybe greater engagement around the basic principles of Europe. Ironically, perhaps we're more European now in the UK than ever before as we contemplate losing it and more engaged with the idea of what the project really means, you know, kind of around peace and cooperation and security, instead of all those narratives that ran on for years and years around, what is it, pink fire engines that we were going to have and all our bananas were going to be straight, weren't they?
Yes, and, the straight bananas,
you know, all these kind of tosh that got put into the popular press around why Europe's so terrible. Maybe now, because it's sort of feeling like it's too late, people are really looking at what was actually there and what it really meant and appreciating it and being more vocal in their appreciation. So who knows, maybe the whole thing will just be a regrettable incident and someone will have to apologise at some point.
I would like to organise an event, a nationwide event on how press could be. Because I think, you know, the way the press is in the UK is appalling, actually. Mm. It's really appalling. It's really, it doesn't represent the population all that well. And plus, and when it, the stuff that gets written on front pages is shocking. It's just like, I mean, yeah, some headlines are funny, but that's about where it stops, right?
Yes, yeah. No, that's true.
Well, you do justify a, you know, potential exodus of not just artists, but people actually want to leave because they're not feeling welcome. I mean, I myself actually felt that way very shortly, I must say, but, you know, right after the vote, I mean, what am I doing? This is my home. I've been here for over 23 years. Yeah. Like you, I've been here longer than I ever was in Spain, and so no man's land, really, limbo. Do you need your mic?
No, I can speak.
Yes, but we need to record. Yes.
Thanks very much. But it's a question really off the back of what you're talking about. I mean, surely this is an opportunity. And we were talking earlier about the EU scientists being very, very mobile on social media and articulating the sorts of things that are risk. And I think the same thing here. I mean, we haven't conceptualized the 800 million that was European City of Culture. We haven't quantified the 40 million. So these sorts of things are not known because, as we've just said, the press seem to sort of sidetrack and have their own agendas to what they put out there. But social media is a very great opportunity for arts, for an opportunity for European artists, and European UK included, to be demonstrating on the broad horizon, loss of funding for arts in the UK, but actually what it gives us into, I mean, you know, we're not aware of that. And I think if you haven't got that forum, I'd be interested to know what you think about that.
Yes, but I also found, I was doing some research for this event. Actually, I was just reading that there was a lot of talk by big cultural public figures in the UK, like manifestos, Sunday manifestos, prior to the referendum. But they all seem to have gone very, very quiet right after the referendum. So I find that a little suspect, and I don't know what, you know, what that might be an indication of. But you know, and that goes back to perhaps, you know, why are not, what Martin was, you know, was saying. I mean, why aren't people more vocal about it?
Jonathan Fryer, I'd like us to focus on the elephant in the room, which has only been partly glimpsed so far, and that's the European single market, and specifically freedom of movement, because this is going to, if Brexit goes ahead, and it is hard Brexit, that will mean no more freedom of movement and no participation in the single market. That is going to hit all the arts very hard indeed, particularly the performing arts, including music, theatre, film and television. And unfortunately, it does seem that hard Brexit is going to be the option. Interestingly, today, the president of the European Council, Donald Tusk, said overtly in a speech, the only alternative to hard Brexit is no Brexit. No prizes for guessing which one I would prefer. But at the moment, the government seems hell-bent on curbing freedom of movement, which will mean we will not be part of the European single market. And for the arts, it's a disaster.
I think it's rather strange that the world, you know, especially with social media, it seems like we're all getting more international, that the world is becoming closer together, that there is no distances anymore. And yet, instead of sort of embracing this kind of holistic approach to the world, being all citizens of the earth, rather than just kind of little countries warring between each other. And yet we got this sort of side of society that is sort of like so scared of this future holistic interaction between people from all cultures and to creating a sort of more futuristic way of being a human being, and yet it's actually going backwards. They want to retain their identity at any cost, not realizing that identity is something that we can share and enrich by sharing with other people. And I don't know if it's, this is a reaction or it's simply it's something that we are going trying to stop progress. And it's interesting that you mentioned the science, because science is another sort of circuit that is going to really feel the loss of the European Union funding. And there is a lot of artists like myself who are collaborating with scientists. So it's going to touch the art world as well, and it's going to perhaps stop this very interesting collaboration between different ambits of society, which perhaps the European Union was trying to promote, and it will be a real loss if we lose that kind of expansion of knowledge and culture. I'm not sure. The other thing that I think about the what you were saying about the press is that you're talking about these newspapers with they're all owned by the same person. So it's no surprise that the news that they produce are kind of like one-sided, even if they try to make up that they are different and they are slightly more one side or the other. In reality, there is a...
I think the those papers are owned by the same person. There are other papers that are owned by different groups. And then there is, of course, the TV news and the radio news. None of these outlets were honest in their reporting. None of them. Honest or even transparent, as a matter of fact.
But why do you think that the pro-European press hasn't been vociferous enough in that defence of the union over the years, not just prior to the referendum, but, you know, let's just, you know, hand up, you know, Europe is not as bad as that media paints it.
I think it's because until Boris Johnson kind of declared his intention to back Brexit, nobody took it seriously. They thought it was just going to be a few extremists with views that they were not shared by the rest of the country, and they will never go any further. So perhaps there was more behind the lines that we didn't know. Mm-hmm. And I even started thinking whether Cameron and Johnson were actually working in a par, and they just play the good policeman, bad policeman, so that they actually got what they wanted. And
that didn't quite work out, did it?
I don't know. Anyway, I don't know.
Then we have a question. Susanna.
Hello. For me, I'm quite preoccupied with the new generations, especially the new generation of artists, so what is going to happen with higher education. I was very privileged that I studied here in 2004. I didn't need a visa or anything. I had the full support from the government, £2,000 fee for a BA that I managed to get paid. I got grants, everything. I finished my university in 2008 with a credit crunch. In 1 year, the prices of the BA jumped from 2,000 to 8,000. So in general terms, nowadays to study, British or European to study, in UK is extremely expensive. The thing is, when I studied to study a BA, it was enough. Nowadays, you need a master. Masters are ridiculously expensive. The problem is, when I studied university, there were people from everywhere. I live in different places in Europe, and I really like London because it's a melting pot. And I found people from everywhere. My biggest concern is if the new generation, they don't have facilities to study in UK, and you don't have the possibility to mix with all the people from other countries, I think it's going to be very bad for the new generations, and also in terms of funding. What do you think, what is going to be the future for Europeans and non-Europeans with university higher education?
Well, I think compared to when I was studying, the universities in art universities in London have become more of a business. And in fact, they all have scouts that go to Asia searching for students because they can pay the outrageous amounts of money that they demand for studying. So I think what you can see, it might be more of a reflection of who can pay can come and study, and then the not so nice thing about it is that the people in England who cannot afford to perhaps go and pay these outrageous prices, they won't have the possibility of perhaps going to Holland or to Germany and choose to do a course there where perhaps is a little bit more.
They are free.
So at least until I know that a lot of English students were going abroad to Europe to study because they had better conditions. And the art schools in England, or at least in London, they have become sort of like the domain of the rich kids that come from abroad and can actually pay these outrageous sums of money. Well, are you going to kind of carry a debt for the rest of your life? Perhaps in another profession is okay because you will end up earning money. But as an artist, any artist here will tell you, it takes many years before you actually, unless you are, you know, lucky like Damien Hirst, that they pick you up in your degree show or something. Most people actually have to work over years and create a practice that establishes them as a serious artist, and then the art world will take them seriously and actually allow them to work. I don't know, perhaps it's one of the worst problems is not for us, the artists who are already settled, but the people who come behind us and how.
Absolutely, in the case of students, I mean, I think, of course, individual fees are horrendous. However, I mean, those programs that, you know, try to foster a common European culture, mm-hmm. like Erasmus, Leonardo, all those are also going to go out of the window. I mean, for me, that's the great tragedy, that, you know, the newer generations are not going to be, like Martin was saying, they're not going to go to Valencia, they're going to find two Erasmus students, you know, in the middle of a, you know, exhibition in Valencia. Nacho, yes.
So just continuing with the topic on the single market, the thing is that apart from the freedom of movement itself, the thing as a market, it has implications for things that people will transit from coming here to London to buy art to galleries to coming here to London to import artwork to their home countries. And I think that is not clear that it will be tax-free, for instance. Mm-hmm. Also, it's the thing is that despite we don't have a solution, in the work market is already affecting, like, for instance, opera centers, etc., that have to make, like, with several years of advance, their planning. The thing is that if they are in the continent, they have to think twice, for instance, to recruit British artists because maybe they need a work permit to work. And so I don't know if you have any insight on this more kind of purely economic, on the economics of the art as a market. And then the other puntualization that I wanted to do, it was on the mobilization of the art world with pre-referendum. That the thing is that the perception that I had, it was limited. So the thing is that there were people that were very, very active, like, for instance, Ian McKellen or Patrick Stewart were very active. But most of the cultural world will tend to be more muted. Like, there was this letter that over 200 artistic figures signed.
That's the one I was referring to.
Yeah, but the thing is that probably 95% of the signatories, that's all they did during the referendum campaign. And the thing is that it went even worse. Like, for instance, I remember the day after the referendum, David Attenborough and Brian Cox saying, oh, how which a tragedy it was. And like, okay, guys, where were you like 2 weeks ago? Because they did not open their mouth during the campaign. So the thing is that a lot of lament that comes now, the thing is that probably it should have come 4 months ago.
No, absolutely. And that last point is a little bit of, you know, don't bite the hand that feeds you, really, in a way, if you want to actually read it that way. But
don't you think this also speaks to the idea that no one thought it would happen?
Yes.
So people weren't mobilised in support of the EU because no one really thought Brexit would happen. So during the campaign around the referendum, I think a lot of artists thought, well, you'd have to be mad to want to leave the EU. Never happen. And frankly, you have better things to do, you know, than enter a political campaign when it didn't seem worth having.
Plus, I don't know what you're referring to, but in political engagement of artists in the UK isn't similar to other European countries. They do actually have other things to do, right?
Well, everybody was so happy to go to the Cool Britannia reception of Tony Blair.
Yeah,
that was political engagement.
The everybody that you mentioned there, and actually that's my point. I'm going to also answer your point about importing and exporting art and etc. All the people that you refer to are the people in the higher echelons of the arts. Money doesn't matter, you know. It's not, I mean, the people who were at Tony Blair's reception, those people make millions of their art. People who are importing, exporting art out of those are collectors. They don't give a monkey's whether they have to pay a little bit more or less. I think Brexit will have no or very little consequence to that group of people. The consequence will actually be on what you said earlier, the individuals, the young artists, and people who are trying to grow from international collaborations. Yeah.
And also what Jonathan was referring to, which you touched upon as well. I mean, trying to move an orchestra from one country to another is extremely expensive. Yeah. If it's already expensive, imagine what it would be like, you know, in a few years' time when, you know, that's not...
Yeah, I can add to that is that the Royal... the KCO, so it's the Royal National Orchestra of the Netherlands, they are very, very well funded. And they are always going to the International Festival in Edinburgh. We are always giving them extra 20K, because otherwise they wouldn't make it.
No.
It's like that.
You have to raise your funds.
We can't. It's not about our funding, actually. It's about what they can't afford in Scotland. And Scotland is better funded than England, funny enough. So, yeah.
Yeah. It's funny, when I was looking through different points of view, and it's right what you said, that the people with most financial power is the ones that are going to suffer the least. And there was one article that was talking about the artists' resale rights. that is being encouraged by the European Union, so that every time an art piece gets sold, the artist gets a little bit of percentage, which means that it's not just, you know, the speculative power of the collectors who buy for peanuts at your degree show and then sell it for millions after a couple of years when you made yourself famous. Of course, the big houses and the people in the upper market, they see this as actually a positive. This might end up helping them, making even more money out of the artists because they won't have to pay a commission or a percentage to the actual person who made the artwork.
Well, there is a push now to make Le Droit de Suite, the artist with sales rights, mm-hmm. International. There's an agreement with the states as well. So if the states goes in it, I'm sure the UK will also jump for the suit. One hopes. Cool. I think Judith had a question.
Yes. Well, I would like to mention another elephant in the room, and that is, I take the long view here. I have seen all the debates and heard and participated for the EU joining the European Union, I mean, the community as it was at the time, never mind that. And then the post-hoc remaking history about what it actually was and so on is quite phenomenal. It's really interesting to see what people actually were told they were getting or wanting or not wanting. And the veto of the French, who said, look, really, the Brits, there's nothing but trouble. You know, as long as De Gaulle was in power, he just didn't want them. And many of my French friends, I have to say, said, he's right there. And, you know, so you have got these long perspectives which are absolutely rooted in history. Of warfare across Europe, you know, especially between Britain and France and all the others. And I think, so when you're saying it's nostalgia, I think you're very kind. I think there are plenty other things there, because I think the EU, the UK has always been a reluctant member of the EU. It sort of was dragged there somehow, and it was totally focused on money, money, money. You'll be better off. And here also we're talking a lot about money. It's not just about that. I really do think, and you were mentioning a bit about the younger people, to have this opportunity of having exchange, of cooperating, etc. I was at university, and I was responsible for the Erasmus program in my department, you can imagine. So everyone wanted to come to London, absolutely everyone. And we had enormous difficulties to get one or two of our students to go maybe for 3 months to out there. And they said, can we go to the US of A? And then we said, well, actually, that's not Europe. Then they said, can we go to Ireland? They speak English, you know. I mean, you have no idea. And then it was really hard work. And, you know, in an architect's department, you have a universal language, you have design and so on. So we thought it might be easier, and we sort of tried to establish some bilateral projects with in Bologna with Italians. I mean, you happen to know them. It was completely arbitrary. So we put the students together, and we had one site in Bologna and one site in London. And they came and went. They designed together. And that sort of then took off, and we had a series of programs, but with very, very hard work behind it all the time. And then, of course, during that time, you had the UK, which said you don't have to know the language in school. Everybody speaks English and so on. So you have this kind of superiority complex, you know, if the Anglo-Saxon world and Big Brother with us all the time in the center of the world. And, you know, we know best, we do best, and you'd better join us if you wish. And you know, I mean, this kind of patronizing attitude, which has been around all the time. From my accent, you can see that I am not born here, but I have lived most of my life here. So I consider myself, A, I'm British, and B, I'm a Londoner. So, you know, but this identity is not respected at all. So you have the sort of treble discrimination at the moment, you know. I mean, A, bloody foreigner, B, females, C, old. You know, what's next? You know, and there is a lot of this very, very big tension, as you said, about even between the generations, which I do not welcome, I must say. I mean, my aim in life when I was working at university was precisely to have to bridge the gap, to actually exchange our knowledge. I believe in symmetry of knowledge. There's nothing to do that you have read more books than the others. You have a different way of seeing and viewing and understanding things, which is very enriching when we can have this exchange between, and even more so, between different cultures, between different mores, etc., etc. And to cut that is absolutely, I mean, it's shooting yourself in your foot, really. And I just would like to say a little anecdote, again, from the long range. When Mitterrand was in power the first time around, his first decree he issued was every functionary, every public servant of France must speak only French. And I was living in Sweden at the time, and we had a big meeting with the scientists, because the French had just established a research ministry, which was very interesting. So the Swedes were very interested in that. And the Swedes have a good connection in between scientists, between France and Sweden. So they invited the minister of research, the new person, to come and explain what it was all about. And they were very interested to see, could we adopt something like that? And the chap was addressing the audience in English. He spoke perfect English, actually. And then he said in English, now I have to switch to French because here is the decree from Mitterrand. I'm not allowed to talk to you in English. And then he had his PowerPoint, which was all in English, and he was making comments in French. And well, cut a long story short, the French scientists have got up in arms because obviously all the scientific publications, the medical publications, biology, they are all in English. I mean, this is the lingua franca for many, many of the hard sciences in any case. And they said, well, if we cannot continue to publish in France in English, we are moving out. And eventually, they had to retreat from that, and this decree had been revoked. But it meant that the scientists really stood up to be counted. And not just scientists, I mean, a lot of other people, precisely in higher education, the artists, etc. I mean, a lot of people really said, can't have that. We cannot be inward-looking and insolent, precisely, La Grande France and all that sort of stuff. And so this is yesteryears. We want to look forward and we want to cooperate outwards, you know, not just with Europe, but also with the world. And I think we are not doing that. It seems to me we're really making an enormous step backwards. And I fear for that because, I mean, I will be not around anymore when the pendulum will finally swing back, because it always does. But I feel the damage which will be done during that time will be enormous, and also there will be personal animosities. I already feel it. I mean, it's really strong. You know, it's very, very sad. And this kind of xenophobia and false superiority, nostalgia of what? Was it all that bloody marvellous in the industrial 19th century? Excuse me, I'm studying this. No, true, not true. But I mean, truths and facts here don't have to bother, you know.
But nostalgia is never about facts, is it? It's by definition, yes, it's a reinventing fantasy,
a history, yes, of
recreated
course.
Place. What I think is interesting is when I first spoke around this idea of retrenchment, that's what I was trying to refer to, is that, you know, forget for a minute the money, what is the actual social meaning of it? And I think it is sinister. I think it is bad. It's a bad spirit in the country when people want to retrench from things and not to step forwards. And I think it's dangerous. I was also really interested in the idea of, if it's hard for young people to come to London and hard for them to come and study, London will itself get poorer. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, yes. London itself, and as Londoners, we have a double vested interest. If London itself doesn't have access to these bright and interesting young people because they can't afford to come, then instead of being this great global city, it'll start to dwindle to a little backwater. And also, I too felt odd the day after the referendum as we walked out into the street. We live in Soho, so we're right in the middle of, you know, it all going on, love our melting pot world, committed to that idea of, you know, kind of, we're all here, so we're all Londoners, and that sort of defines us more fully than anything else. And we walked around the streets thinking, is this the place we thought it was? And do we feel that we belong here anymore, even though we're, you know, kind of born Brits, born Londoners? Mm. Because our ideology is around that mixture and connection and outwardness, not retrenchment. So do we have a Do we have a place? And then, you know, kind of, if you want to do, you know, kind of foreigner woman, well, you know, kind of gay, you know, kind of like aging also, you know, kind of, isn't that the great thing about Europe was that it supported the sort of fundamental truth about us as equal and connected, regardless of those differences. And so there's a much bigger spiritual, ideological piece. I'm absolutely with you.
I think it's funny, we got a picture here of Winston Churchill looking at me.
Well, did he invent it? Didn't Winston Churchill invent the EU or something bonkers?
No, he actually said that if you stop spending money in art, he said, one of the reasons was this would be fought in World War, precisely to defend
culture.
And the culture. I think part of this nostalgia has to do with the fact that two European wars were actually kind of not won by the British, although perhaps Britain liked to think that they won.
British
the war.
Think they did, yeah.
The thing that the whole of Europe got invaded, apart from Britain, and it was like the centre where they make all the army retreat back into their own country, the Germans in this case. But I think it's interesting that the people who are now wanting to be independent from Europe, and the people who actually have this nostalgia are actually the people whose beliefs are the same as Hitler's were. So these are the right-wing party, the kind of Nazis portion of society, are the ones who wants to retreat from Europe and are following the dictates of an European leader, which was Hitler. So they think, you know, white supremacy and all of this, and they actually have adopted this as part of their nostalgic, let's go back to be British. I find this concept quite interesting.
It's also interesting that it's not just the right, the extreme right, who actually, you know, went for leaving Europe. I think a great chunk of Labour voters also voted for leave. That, for me, is a worrying bit and very disturbing. So, you know.
But I think they were led to that. I think that a lot of people actually were fed lies, mm-hmm. and sort of inflated ideas, and they actually didn't realise what they were voting for. And I think perhaps some of these people now are thinking, my God, what have we done? Mm-hmm. Out of ignorance or out of not researching or not sort of like informing themselves about what they were doing.
Yeah, but that perhaps goes back to the Remain campaign wasn't very...
Yes, yeah.
You know, I don't want to go into those details. No, it definitely wasn't effective. But I mean, there was a lot of on the ground, you know, people fighting, you know, and really, really making themselves heard, you know, for Remain. But I'm not sure whether that actually projected or actually came across to the rest of voters. I mean, there was a lot of passion, believe me, I mean, on the streets. And we have one here, actually, every single day was actually in the streets of Fulham and outside Sloane Square Station. You know, so that's the thing, I think. But in any case, that's too late now, I think.
Yes.
You know, unfortunately, it's too late. So I think it's very, very little point to say, oh, what if? I mean, but among all this, can we see any positives? Can we see any opportunities? Because I'd much rather look at that and just sit here, say, I know it's very depressing. And actually, one more point, because we're talking about Europeans and citizens of the European Union in London or in the UK. However, I know for a fact that those non-Europeans, also residents in the UK, are also badly depressed and affected by the decision. And I say that looking at you, Susan. And actually, I know that you were first, but if you don't mind, Nacho, to pass the mic to Susan, I really would love to hear what you have to say about it.
Hello, everyone. Is this on? Hello, hello?
Yes, don't worry, it's just being recorded.
Oh, right.
Yeah, we all hear
great.
You.
Oh, so I just sound normal to those in the room. So I'm Susan, and I'm an American who's made Britain my home since 2000, so for 16 years. And it has been quite, shall I say, a fascinating experience also being another international here. A few days after Brexit, in fact, I was with an American expat girlfriend on the bus. She sounds much more loud American than I do, and a young Brit started crying, just broke down into absolute tears in the bus because she heard these American voices. And this circa 19, 20-year-old young lady is profusely apologising on behalf of the nation and is horribly embarrassed. And it was terrible for us in that we had to jump off the bus kind of in two stops, so we couldn't really console her. But essentially, what was fascinating to me is for the 16 years I've been here, I've seen this very much so as embracing all cultures. And I thought for the first time, although she was very much so sympathetic and I really appreciated her expressing her feelings, it was obvious that for the first time, certainly since I've been in the country, I was really standing out. And what's to come next? We don't know. I know that's what you're exploring tonight, but I do actually think to a certain extent as well, there's perhaps been a bit of, and I don't mean to criticise anyone in the room at all for whatever's being said, but sometimes people are forgetting that there are other internationals in the city as well, and I no longer feel welcome to a large extent. And I, like many people, am working out my next plans. In my case, watching the US presidential election, and I'll make no commentary there.
Yeah, your own problems there.
So I hope that was helpful. And if you want the American voice any more in this discussion, I'm happy to contribute.
Thank you, Susan.
I think, you asked for a positive note. I think we can all sort of be pleased that as a group, and the reason I'm saying this is that... most of my working week and free weekends, for what they are, I hang out with people who are in the creative, cultural, or whatever, you know, and so they are everything that you are, plus more. And every now and then I step out and step into the sort of more financial or law, and then I'm shocked, and then I feel unwelcome, and I felt like you. I felt I was criticized for my, how can you speak such well English but with such an accent? I've never heard that before in my life. But the moment I step back into this world, it just doesn't matter. In fact, I feel just me. I'm not judged. I'm just a person. So I think on a positive note, let's keep that one up, I think tolerance has all, like you were saying about Churchill, as a matter of fact, and perhaps you are referring to that Europe was set up after the Second World War mainly, it's nothing to do with money, it was mainly to create more tolerance and collaboration between European countries. Well, let's start with the arts then. Mm-hmm. Why not?
Well, in fact, the arts and the creation of the Arts Council took place, 1947?
Yeah.
So right after the end of the war, I think that should have sent signals that, it's almost a declaration of intentions, really. Yeah. I like that process. I'd like to, take that. Nacho, would you still like to? You're okay. Okay, that's great. Great. Well, I think we should leave it here. We can continue. We're going to have a few... some wine being served, so you don't want to stay behind. And yes,
I love everything.
Before we go, I asked Daphne for the positives. I would like to hear your positives as well.
I think actually, really to the point around the rhetoric around Europe. For the whole time we've been in the European Union, the UK has carped about it, complained about it. Great advocates of the EU have had to say it's not as bad as you think it is. And what's happened now is people stand up and say they're really proud to be part of the EU, and that it's not about apologising for it, but being incredibly vocal around one's affection for the project and what it means, and what it means on all levels. So I think, ironically, in the crisis of Brexit, there's this really positive piece around people appreciating Europe without apologising for it.
The positive, what I said earlier about the fact that it might create more of a response of artists trying to kind of fight these trends of separatism and this in sort of like strong beliefs that perhaps are touching on is very extremist. So perhaps the new artists are going to be a little bit more vocal and take more of an interest in society and how society progress, but perhaps now they're going to have to find something else to complain about, and it's going to be something in the country rather than outside the country.
Mm-hmm. Good. That's great. And I suppose my positive would be that, if anything, what this a process has, I suppose, fostered is, I think, something that was needed, which is soul-searching in terms of the overall European project. So if anything, let's take that away with us to say, you know, we will continue to be Europeans. Absolutely. I think the arts and the artists, as Martin, all of us, I think, here agree, will continue creating wonderful pieces. Mm-hmm. How? We don't know. In what terms? What finance sort of level of support? We don't know. But it will continue. I think that's clear. And I think it's everyone's interest, not just Europe, but the UK as well, that's the case. So let's hope.
Mm-hmm. In my case, I'm actually have declared my intention to clean the Thames. So I'm going to clean all the rubbish, be European, English, or whatever, or American, or whatever comes, or Dutch, it might come with the tide, you're right. So, yes.
Yes. And Daphne?
The Dutch embassy, i.e. moi, are organizing two workshops. On the 4th of November is a workshop, Cultural Collaborations After Brexit, and we are focusing on fashion. And the second one is on the 11th of November, Cultural Collaborations After Brexit, focusing on the creative industries as a whole. And basically, do please join us all, because then we can continue this discussion.
Do you have a contact that they can go to?
You can literally come to me, basically. If you're interested, come and find me. I'll have a drink afterwards. Mm-hmm. They are basically both held at the Dutch Centre near Bank Tube Station in the city.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
Thank and free you. As well.
Important at this time of age.
That's great.
That's great. And just to finish, just let me tell you a little bit more about the next two events that we have as part of Spain Now 2016. The first one coming up will be on the 31st of November at the Hospital Club, where Maria actually will showcase two wonderful pieces going back to that project where she's cleaning up the Thames. So I would recommend you all tell along
rubbish.
And see it on the 31st.
Literally.
And yeah, you will giving us will be giving us an introduction to the project on the 3rd of November as well.
Yes, that's right.
Lunchtime talks, artist talks at the Hospital Club between 1 and 2. And all those details are actually on the Spain Now website. And on the 8th of November, that's just hot off the press, we will premiere Martin's short film on the Fanzara project that he was telling us about at the beginning. It's a wonderful, wonderful project, and it's a great film. Again, it will be available, Martin, after the premiere for everyone to watch, so keep an eye out. We will send you all the details. And accompanying the premiere of Martin's short film, we will also have the world premiere of the documentary Project Homer, which is by the National Youth Theatre Company of Spain. And it's just a great, again, overview of the work that they're doing. There will be part of the residence at the Lyric Hammersmith, and they will also be present here during the week. That will take place on the 8th of December, as I said, at the London College of Communications. More details to follow. And anyway, so this is it for tonight. As I said, there's some wine available, so please do stay, have a glass with us, and let's continue the conversation. Thank you very much. I hope that you take away with you the positives as well as all the other issues that we've been talking about, and that if anything, tonight has served as a group therapy session, which I think we all needed this day and age. So thank you very much.
Thank you.